Hello, my name is Osa Juvonen. I'm a senior program manager in Microsoft Corporation. In this particular video, we'll concentrate on site collection and site provisioning with adding model. Adding model means essentially the same as the more traditional terminology, which was app model. So the key point here is that how do we provision site collections and subsites, or how do we modify those sites using then the adding model techniques? We're going to start with a kind of a quick look back on the different site provisioning patterns within the SharePoint and SharePoint Online. So which of those are still usable, and but what are those challenges also within those individual patterns, for example, when you use them within the Office 365 or within the on-premises. Then we'll concentrate on site provisioning with CSAM or RESTful APIs, essentially meaning the remote APIs. So how we can create site collections and subsites, and how do we control them or apply configurations to their sites using the remote APIs. Then we'll move into the hybrid models with SharePoint provisioning. So how can you create sites from on-premises to the cloud, or actually from the cloud to the on-premises. So both of these options are absolutely valid and can be actually applied or implemented using the adding model techniques. And then the final topic is updating existing site collections. And what I mean with that one is that now that you have provisioned your sites and site collections using the CSAM or remote APIs, how would I actually then modify those individual sites? And what is the what are those models? How do we minimize the maintenance challenges related on using remote APIs for updating these individual site collections and subsites? Before we go to the actual topic of the presentation, we really wanted to quickly go through the developer vision as well. And the Office development is actually pretty huge. There's already more than 1.2 billion users in Office worldwide, so it is absolutely a huge opportunity to provide a window for your application. And we do have a standardized store mechanisms to deploy your customizations or add-ins or apps across individual Office applications. So the key point here is that we're able to reach these end users using whatever devices they're actually using, whatever screen size which the device actually have. And we're able to publish your customizations towards the end users across multiple companies using the standardized store mechanism. And the other topic on the slide is also the data. We really want to get to this point where all of our data is accessible using whatever device, whatever technique, whatever platform you're using. So you can access that data using the remote APIs, and you can also manipulate and add that data or manipulate the functionalities using these remote APIs. So this is absolutely a huge opportunity for any developer looking into reaching a significant amount of customers in the easiest possible way. We'll start with the recommendations. So this is a slide where we go through the key topics and key recommendations within the presentation. So how do we? What are those main recommendations among which we mention and justify as part of this module? And the first one is that do not use site or web templates, and this also includes site definitions. These are pretty old technologies. They do work productively well and they are supported, but they do have a long-term and a short-term and a long-term impact for your deployment. You might actually get a new site with the right definitions, but then whenever we do innovation in Office 365 or actually in SharePoint on-premises as well, you might run into the challenges. And we'll talk about that slightly more during the upcoming slides. So if you don't use site or web templates, what is the right option? The right option is to use a remote provisioning pattern. Essentially, what it means is that we are deploying or creating sites and configuring the sites and site collections using those remote APIs which we now have available. And that includes the CSAM and RESTful APIs within the SharePoint and SharePoint Online. We also recommend that you deploy your artifacts and assets to these sites without feature framework elements. The feature framework was introduced back in SharePoint 2007, actually already 2006, and that's a pretty old technology. The downside of using the feature framework is that you actually leave a dependency on your customization, what has been deployed, or a reference to that from that customization to a solution files or element XML files within the 15 Hive or within the Sandbox Solution Store or Solutions Gallery. And that actually might hit you or might cause you additional challenges within the future. We do have a much more powerful remote APIs, and when you're using a code, you can actually debug your deployment mechanism so that everything goes to the right location. If that something doesn't work right, you're able to figure it out by debugging your code. With the feature framework, you don't have that capability. So you essentially, it's an try and error, trying to figure out based on troubleshooting what was wrong within your XML files. And also updating the remote, updating your sites using the remote management pattern. That means that whenever we need to do updates within your existing site collection, let's say that there's a V2 of your template coming, or there's a new branding which needs to be applied, we should be looking into using those remote APIs as well. And this is actually pretty typical. So if we compare to the farm solutions or sandbox solution deployments, you might have used feature framework for deploying your assets and configurations to the SharePoint. But then whenever you needed to do any updates, you were pretty much forced to use anyway some code. So either server-side code or client-side code to actually modify the site and the definitions within the site. And this is really because even though we introduced the feature framework upgrade framework back in 2010, SharePoint 2010, it really wasn't giving us all the benefits, and in majority of the case, you were still using upgrade feature upgrading events. Essentially, you were forced to write some code to apply the needed customizations to the site. And essentially, now we're just taking granted of that similar thinking and similar pattern, but using a remote APIs to apply these configurations. So let's move on to site provisioning models and SharePoint. And the whole point of this one is that we'll have a look on the historical approaches of provisioning sites. When you think about SharePoint, it really is all about creating a site. You need to have the site, then you apply configurations to the site or assets to the site before the end users actually start using the site. The typical solutions have been then site templates, feature framework, and so all of those. So we'll have a look on those individual options and what are those challenges and specific challenges within the specific options. We'll go through many of these options within the upcoming slides. There are a few other variations of these things which we don't go through for the sake of time, but we'll touch base them within the recording audio. So let's start with the feature stapling. Feature stapling is a classic way of modifying out-of-the-box site definition provisioning model. And what I mean with that one is that with the feature stapling, you essentially deployed a stapler feature, where you were saying that now that when you were associating that whenever somebody creates an out-of-the-box theme site, let's actually associate additional feature to be activated as part of that site provisioning. So whenever then somebody actually created that out-of-the-box theme site, your custom feature was activated as part of the site provisioning process, and you would be able to apply customizations to the site. So it's a pretty well-known and highly used capability within a farm solution scale, for example, for customizing My Sites or OneDrive for Business Sites. There's a few challenges of the feature stapling approach. First of all, you cannot use that to bring in new template options. So if you might have a requirement to have, for example, two different kind of theme sites, you cannot actually use feature stapling for that. You can only modify any of the existing site definitions deployed to the farm. And also in Office 365, this is capability is only available at the site collection scope with the sandbox solutions. Typically, I think majority of the field, or we know that majority of the field were using the feature stapling in a farm scope or in a web application scope. So we were able to actually then associate the feature stapling in a much more higher level. The second option, what we're looking into is the site definition provisioning process. So this is really the classic system available since 2003, and we made a significant changes on it in 2007. We simplified the ONNET XML process, and people were much more easily adaptable for the site definition approach. What the site definition requires is that we are deploying a webtemp XML file to the 15 template and language ID folder, which is an XML folder, which is introducing that new template to be available. And that actually associates to the onet XML file, which is deployed within the 15 Hive template site templates folder. That onet XML file is then associating or referencing individual features which are activated whenever the new site is actually created. So it's a capability which is providing us a new site option to be available for the end users. And essentially, it's pretty much copying the same capability as out-of-the-box site definitions. And that was typically the way we created this. We copied an onet XML from out-of-the-box theme site or out-of-the-box other site out-of-the-box site definitions. And then we modified that based on our business requirements. That wasn't, to be honest, the most efficient way or the recommended way to create site definitions because that actually had, again, some other implications. But let's not actually go on the technical details of site definition in this presentation. The challenges of the site definitions is that it actually impacts on a major version upgrade. All of the sites which have been creating or used or created using a custom site definitions are not upgraded in the same way as using an out-of-the-box site definitions. There are certain upgrade definitions for the major version upgrade, meaning from 2010 to 2013 to 2013 to 2016, which are associated in a site definition level. So none of those activities would be automatically executed for your custom sites created using a custom site definition. Site definitions are not also available in Office 365 because they actually require deployment of files in the 15 Hive, essentially meaning the file system and in a farm level. And that means that it's not available in the multi-tenant deployments like Office 365 itself. Since there was quite a lot of, let's say, limitations and challenges with the site definitions, we introduced a web template back in SharePoint 2010. It was actually initially introduced for better support for site templates, but you can actually use them manually in quotes as well. And what with manually, we mean that you create that web template manually using Visual Studio. So you don't actually start by saving a site as a template and then extracting or importing that template to the Visual Studio. Because that actually has quite a lot of additional assets which doesn't have to be there. So creating this manually in Visual Studio was one option, and we do know that there's a lot of people who are actually using this. There's certain challenges of doing this. So the, obviously that it provided us the new site options, which was a good thing that they were able to introduce new site options in a selected template functionality. And they were still, and all of the sites which we provisioned were associated to the out-of-the-box site definition. So what we mean with that one is that now that even though site was created using an alternative to onet XML in the provisioning time, this afterwards site was saying that it's an out-of-the-box theme site or it's an out-of-the-box publishing site, whatever root template you actually decided to use. Now, there are challenges related on this one, which are highly related on the minor version updates, which we're introducing in a farm. And I will go through that slightly more detailed in upcoming slides. But the fact that whenever we create a web template, the web template actually, or you create a site based on a web template, we don't activate stapled features, which are associated to the root template of that web template. And what we mean with that one is that, as an example, you take an onet XML of a theme site and you create a new template out of that onet XML of a theme site, and you define the web template root template to be a theme site. None of the stapled features which are associated in a theme site, out-of-the-box theme site, are activated automatically. You could have actually tackled this by using or adding those feature definitions to the onet XML of the web template as well. But we do actually modify the stapled feature set as part of our updates. And that could actually cause significant maintenance challenges for your deployment because we completely replaced the out-of-the-box site definition. And we also support this site web templates only in Office 365 in a site collection level. And that's simply because we cannot support them in a farm scoped, even though they are supported in a farm scoped in the on-premises, because that would require that they are deployed to the 15 hive. Essentially, again, they would be across the farm, across all of the tenants which are hosted in the one farm in the multi-tenant environment. Then the kind of a final option, there's multiple adaptations of the full server-side custom solutions, but absolutely you could implement the service, the site collection creations using just server-side APIs and extend that and create whatever additional enterprise-level solutions using this option as well. And we do know that there's a lot of customers who've done this. As an example, in a picture, we have a self-serve site collection creation form, which is slightly custom compared to out-of-the-box one. Then all of those requests are stored in the list, for example, in a SharePoint, which we have an approval workflow associated. Whenever the item is approved, there's a timer job, which is then actually creating the site collection and sending email for the end users. Pretty typical setup. These options, and because the server-side code are not supported in Office 365, it requires a full trust code of farm solutions to be deployed, and they can be pretty complex to set up and maintain. So they're not necessarily the best option for the future as well. So we mentioned the challenge, the maintenance challenge related on the web templates, and let's actually have a look on this one slightly more detailed. What does it actually mean? So if we create a web template or actually also on site definitions, if you would be creating them, or you save site as a template, actually this applies to that challenge as well. We start by copying the ONNET XML of an out-of-the-box team site or whatever site you're using as your reference. So typically we copy the ONNET XML, we start modifying the ONNET XML based on the business requirements. And then after a while in Office 365, we release a new version of the service. We do releases in a bi-weekly basis right now, and which might change in the future. But there's quite a lot of new additional innovation coming to the sites. And what would happen is that we can actually associate or add new stapled features, for example, to this out-of-the-box theme site. Your custom web template would not be evolving based on those newly added functionalities. And after a while, there might be a pretty significant difference comparing your site, even though it was based on the out-of-the-box theme site. But because of those stable features are not activated for your web template or the sites created using the web template, the end behavior or end experience might be completely different between your ONNET XML and the out-of-the-box theme site. And as like mentioned, this actually applies to custom web template, but this also applies on the site template. So the key challenge here is that all of the old sites, they're being taken care of by the upgrade mechanism. But now you have a template which is stored available for the end users to create new sites. So all of the new sites which we are creating based on the old templates will be the problematic ones. And they will be then lacking the latest features which are compared to the out-of-the-box site. Now, you can absolutely go and update your templates, but that's actually the maintenance challenge. So you need to keep up what kind of templates you have available across individual site collections deployed as a sandbox solution in Office 365, and what are those updates which we actually release towards our out-of-the-box theme site. And this is where the remote provisioning pattern will absolutely help you. And it's much more flexible, and it always gets you the latest and greatest capabilities from the out-of-the-box template side perspective. And we're going to talk about that one slightly later on the presentation. So quite often when we talk about this one, people are then asking that, wait, so web templates were absolutely the best option in SharePoint 2010. What has been changed? And the key change here is the better remote APIs. We can absolutely now create site collections and sites and modify those sites and site collection based on our business needs, just using these remote APIs. So we don't have to have dependency on feature XMLs and XML definitions, and we can still do easier deployments, and we can also debug our deployment mechanism much more easily. And the second dimension of this all is that we really want to think about this in a way that let's standardize the site provisioning. So what if we could use the same model for on-premises and cloud? Not think about cloud as an exception or the on-premises as an exception. Rather think about an implementation pattern which will be applicable for both sites, both for cloud and both for on-premises. And this is where the SharePoint remote provisioning actually comes in. And what we mean with the SharePoint remote provisioning is that we have the SharePoint, we have then an external code running somewhere outside of the SharePoint, which has its own app in specific configuration or own specific configuration. And that's the one which is actually creating those site collections to the SharePoint service. It might have an UI, it might not have an UI, it might be a PowerShell, it might be a console application, it might be whatever is needed for your business case. But the key point here is that that code which is actually creating the site collection is using the remote APIs to create the site collection using out-of-the-box site definition. It will then use the remote APIs to upload the right assets, for example, CSS files and JavaScript files to the right folders. It will then use the remote APIs to create content types and site columns before the site is actually then shared for the end users to start modifying or start actually using the site itself. So wait, does it mean that no more feature framework? And that's actually absolutely correct. We are moving away from the feature framework. We do recommend move to remote provisioning patterns rather than the feature framework usage. Do multiple different, let's say, benefits of doing that. We are absolutely aware that the feature framework is still promoted by Visual Studio tooling, and those tools are awesome now that in 2013 timeframe. At the same time, when you use the feature framework, you have these maintenance challenges which might bite you and cause you additional cost in the future. So we really need to think about closely what kind of options and what kind of coding options you really want to use in the future when you create sites and site collections. So let's actually have a look on different site provisioning options, and just a kind of a comparison slide. Let's go through the options one by one and think about what does it actually mean and what is the challenge and what is the recommended option as well. So the site definitions, they're not supported in Office 365. They do have a long-term impact on costs. They block transition to the cloud because those sites are using an alternative template. You can absolutely convert that using migration tooling, but it's an additional long-term impact within a cost because you need to consider that as part of your transition. And it actually causes significant issues with the future migration and upgrades in general. Options available are good because you have high flexibility when you're creating your own custom site definition. You're building on the same engine as the out-of-the-box functionalities. But the cost impact is absolutely, in the short and the long term, is actually quite big and high. Site template has a really poor site collection creation story. Theoretically, you can actually create a site collections without a template, then upload a site template and apply the template for it. But that's not really a viable solution. It's not really an enterprise-ready solution. It has a negative impact on upgrades because your sites and the site templates don't actually upgrade. So, as an example, we had multiple customers who had challenges with their site templates, which were saved in 2010. And whenever we moved to 2013, none of those templates worked in the 2013 environment. So that is again causing you additional challenges related on maintenance costs within the service updates as well. So all of these new versions which we're introducing. Site templates are not also available with publishing features. So whenever the publishing features are enabled, you cannot go to the site settings and save site as a template. So that option is not available, and they're not supported with publishing features. It is supported in Office 365. Options available are Sphere. A cost impact short and a long term is slightly less than site definition, but it's still pretty hectic, or well, you need to consider that. Web templates has a poor site collection creation story, especially in Office 365. In on-premises, you can actually do that relatively easily. They causes maintenance costs with service updates as well. We went through that slide a few minutes ago. Supported in Office 365 in site collection scoped. Options available are average. We're able to use publishing features, for example, with web templates. And then the cost impact is pretty much the same as in site templates, even though there's some differences. Server-side provisioning, provision out-of-the-box sites, but modify them based on a user selection and requirements. Standardization of site creation code, no Office 365. That's probably the biggest challenge. So this would be a specific only for on-premises, and then you need to reconsider if and when your deployment is looking into do hybrid or Office 365 deployment. The flexibility of this one is absolutely good, because you can do pretty much whatever you like. Remote provisioning, we use and we support site creation of site collections and subsites in on-premises and in cloud using the client-side object model. We can then use the same engine, or pretty much the same engine, and the same thinking across the different hosting platforms. So now you could actually use the same code in the on-premises or within the Office 365. We can do this from any external system, so it's up to us to think about what is our adding hosting platform. Is it a Microsoft Azure with the web jobs and storage queues and all of those goodies, or it might be something that you're hosting in an IIS platform, whatever is your chosen path. When I think about this one, the cost impact short and long term is slightly actually bigger than the server-side provisioning, because you need to consider that hosting, and you need to consider the creation story of those individual sites. But that cost, especially in the long term, is getting down, because now you are always creating stuff using out-of-the-box site definitions, and we don't have the any maintenance challenges, what we might have, for example, with site templates and web templates. So let's move on to actual site provisioning with adding model or app model. So what does it actually mean, and what are those options? So why would we actually do this? What we are planning to do is provision new site collections from the adding site. It can be used to override out-of-the-box self-service site creation form relatively easily from your Office 365 settings or your web application settings within the on-premises. And we can absolutely use this to integrate additional functionality as part of the provisioning from a self-service site collection creation perspective. And what we mean with that one is quite often people are asking additional metadata, additional options whenever the end user goes and requests a site. Or you might even have a billing, organizational and billing-based approach associated to this self-service site collection creation. How we would do this, Office 365 has a separate downloadable which includes the needed CSAM elements to provision sites, and this is the tenant API. And in on-premises after SharePoint 2013-2014 April CU, it is natively supported in on-premises. So you need to update that April CU or later version, and you can actually create site collections in on-premises just by using client-child object model as well. And what does it actually mean? So in this case, this is the typical case of creating site collections using an async provisioning model, but using the adding model. So the end user goes to some UI, a self-service site collection creation UI, selects what kind of template he or she wants to use, provides whatever additional metadata, additional settings for the creation. We can optionally absolutely still have that request stored in a list, for example, or in a storage queue. It could be a SharePoint list if we're looking into having an approval workflow associated to that list. Then we would have a remote timer job in Microsoft Azure. That would mean a web job. In on-premises, that might mean, for example, a console application or a PowerShell, which is a scheduled PowerShell, which is accessing that list and checks do we have approved requests, which we need to process in every single 5 minute. Whenever that's actually true, the remote timer job will then create the actual site collection with the needed configuration, needed settings, and then it will send an email for the end user that your site collection is now available. One of the reasons why we recommend this to be an async or asynchronous is the fact that site collection creation takes typically quite a long time. So you really don't want to show a GIF animation, a rotating GIF animation for the end user for the 15 minutes or whatever the time frame is, how long the site collection creation takes. It slightly depends in Office 365, but also in on-premises based on the current load of the system. In provisioning time, we mentioned this a few times, but in the provisioning time, it's really, really important to realize that the remote timer job is now the one who always creates the new site collection using out-of-the-box site definition. It doesn't use web templates, doesn't use site templates, always creates the site using out-of-the-box site definition. Could be a team site, could be a PubSync site, could be some other out-of-the-box site definition as well. And then what happens is that the following step is then the key. Based on the end user selection within that custom form, we then kind of specialize that site using the client-side object model, using the remote APIs. So we kind of apply our customization on top of the out-of-the-box site definition. And this way, the site is out-of-the-box team site, but it has been automatically modified before the end users arrive to that site with the business requirements and with the functional requirements. So from a long-term impact perspective, the SharePoint still thinks that it's an out-of-the-box team site, but then it has been modified based on the business requirements, which could have been done manually as well. But obviously, if you have a business case to minimize the time for the end users to start using the site, you might want to automate this applyment of branding, applyment of content type, site columns, or whatever needs to be done within your site collection. Typically, then the question is that, wait, so does that mean that I need to write an entire custom engine for this? The answer is not necessarily. Right now, within your on-premises deployment or within your farm solution, or you might have an on-premises or farm solution based deployment, somebody actually needs to create the site. Whoever is creating the site, we can actually change the process slightly. We can actually create the site using PowerShell. We can create the sites using feature activations and so on. Or you could actually have one person who's waiting for even calls to request those sites. So having that kind of a mechanical Turk approach, which is absolutely valid in the future as well. If you want to automate this, that's doable as well. That's the key point here. And we do have a ready-to-use community-driven code, which is helping you to do automation and automation of the site collection provisioning or the on-premises sub-site provisioning as well. So there's a lot of existing code and a lot of existing IP which you can reuse almost as such within your deployment if needed. Again, it slightly depends on your business requirements. So you need to really evaluate those options from your end user or from your deployment perspective. So let's actually move to the demo. So let's have a look on the site collection provisioning. And in this case, this is a patterns and practices sample called provisioning.cloud.async, which is taking advantage of the Microsoft Azure and storage queues and web jobs to actually create site collections on fly based on the end user request. Hello. In this video, we'll have a look on how to build an asynchronous site collection creation experience for the end users so that you're able to, for example, build a self-service site collection creation UI where the end users are able to request a site collection. Those requests are stored for approval. Whenever they are approved, they are then actually stored or processed and the site collection is created properly. And this particular example is part of the patterns and practices guidance example, so it's called Provisioning Cloud Async, and it actually consists from two different solutions, and I'm going to explain why. So this is the first solution. This is the UI part. So this is where the end user, this is the one which is implementing the user interface, which also needs to be installed on the SharePoint farm, and that's why we have this app project here, which is introducing the app itself, and that's the provider hosted application side of the solution. Like with all of the our patterns and practices guidance thing examples, we have the README, which is explaining the details of the solution. The second part of the solution is an isolated console application, so it's actually a different solution. It could be absolutely in a one solution as well, but it's called Provisioning Cloud Async Console. And this is actually our remote time job. So this is the fellow who's responsible of going and checking, are there any requests in the queue, In this case, it's a SharePoint list-based queue. It could be based on storage queues, and this could be actually implemented as a web job as well. But we wanted to keep things simple for this slightly more simplified sample. But anyway, this is the remote timer job, which is actually accessing the SharePoint and checking, do we have anything to process? Do we have anything to process? And whenever we do, it is then actually starting the creation of a site collection, where it needs to have a pretty high permission. So it actually has a tenant administrator permission given by the OAuth tokens, but using the app-only token approach. So let's start the demo, and let's do an F5 in the UI part. So we're actually installing this UI part to my dev site. And the first thing, what it actually does when it installs the UI part, it is asking us to trust that UI. Technically, this UI part is actually creating a list or adding an item to that list in a host web. So it doesn't actually need to have that high permissions. But it is actually asking tenant administrative permissions for the sake that we'll use the same permissions within our remote timer job as well. We could absolutely register an alternative client ID and a secret pair, but this is one way of sharing the same ID across your individual solutions, or especially in this case when we have that external remote timer job running somewhere else. So I'm going to trust that provider hosted application, and you can actually see the UI, which can be used then to request the new site collections by the end users. So we're able to pick what kind of a template do we actually want to do. Let's do a template. Let's give it a name. Let's give it a name called name. Let's give it a URL for the site. Let's call this BNB site call. And give it an email to notify when the request has been processed. So let's do something like vesaj@vescoonline.com and give it a description. And now that we click the create, we don't actually start the creation of the site collection. What we do is that we make sure that we have a list available where we're able to store that request. So the first thing what we do is that we run ensure request list, and because the request list isn't there within a site collection, in the host web, it will actually create the list using then following lines of code. So it actually adds the necessary fields, necessary columns running the CSAM to the host web. And now the list already exists. And now we're adding those additional columns to the list. And then we're able to proceed. Then it takes the instance of an end user. It adds that request to the queue. So let's actually have a quick look on that one. We are collecting that information what we just entered in the UI, the name, site URL, templates, and so on. And we are adding a status to be requested. So it's ready to be processed, but it hasn't been yet processed properly. And the key point from this side now, the UI part is actually saying this one. So it is an asynchronous process. The end user doesn't have to wait the site collection to be created, because it might actually take quite a long time, depending on an environment. Is it an on-prem? Is it a cloud? And what is the current load of that environment? So essentially, we're saying your request that has been recorded with this particular settings, and we'll process your request automatically. We will send you an email whenever that processing has completed. Actual request in this particular case is stored in a SharePoint list. So if I click proceed, I can actually go to the list itself, which is a site requests list, which was created, which is having that request now stored. And this is the list which we used for the status tracking as well. So the status is now requested. In this particular case, we don't have any approval attached to this one, but this would be the list would be the perfect place to have that approval process included. And then whenever we are checking are there ready requests to be processed, we would be making sure that those requests have been already approved. So there's our request. And now we need to have that remote timer job part. So remote timer job is essentially, it might be code, it might be PowerShell, it might be a provider hosted application, it might be whatever code or whatever thingy which is running somewhere and contacting the SharePoint and operating using the CSAM APIs. And this particular case, it's our console application, which I showed already when we started the video. To be able to access the SharePoint, we need to use a valid client ID and a secret. So we need to have a valid client ID and a secret available to be able to connect to the SharePoint site. To get those properly, in this case, what I'm going to do is that I'm going to move into my provider hosted application site, because that had those pretty high permissions. I'm just taking advantage of that client ID and secret, which was already registered. In a real world, you might be doing the same, or you might be registering a separate pair of client ID and secrets for the console application. Again, it slightly depends. There's multiple factors to make that decision. So I'm going to copy that client ID and a secret to my console application. I'm pointing to that URL where my requests are stored. That was a dev site underneath my site. And then there should be a list called site requests. So I'm going to put a breakpoint here. The good thing about when you're doing a remote timing jobs, we don't have any timeouts, because in a provider hosted application time, if you start debugging the code and it takes too long, what will happen is that the IIS process will time out, and therefore you cannot access the site, or the process will not be completed. But in this case, it's a console application, so I'm going to actually run start with an F5. And what we're doing is that, first of all, we are getting that site URL, the target site where the list is located, and where do we have given those permissions with the client ID and a secret. And what we're doing here is that we're taking advantage of the app-only access token. So now the end user permissions doesn't matter. We've given a access app-only access for that client ID and a client secret. And moving on, we are then accessing that individual list, which is there. There's our list. And then we're doing a COM query, where we go that towards the list and say, give us all the items which are in a requested status. And I'm actually interested about 10 of those. So a really small amount of items at the once time. And then we get a list of list items available for processing. This time it's only one, because it's the same one which we were actually accessing. And because the site creation might take a long time, and there's just a double checking, we're reloading that item and making sure that it's still in requested status before we actually start processing. And then the following line is there to make sure that it's no longer in a requested status. So if there would be multiple processes accessing the same list, we would now go and update that list to be in a new status. It's going to be in a provisioning status. So let's actually update that one properly and get back on the site collection creation. Before we go there, let's double check that our entry is properly updated. So there's our site requests. I'm going to do a refresh. And now you're able to see that the status is actually provisioning, and the provisioning has started on a certain time. It's just a good practice to have that additional message there, so you actually know is it now somehow in hold status, or has there been an exception or whatever. And now this item won't be no longer available for the processing if there's multiple threads accessing the same item. It's now in processing status, not in requested status. So let's actually process the start request. So I'm going to go to this method, which is then walking through the actual creation of the site collection. So let's see that we actually get we are resolving what is this tenant admin UI, or the URL. And there's my tenant admin URL, tvsaj.admin.sharepoint.com. And then I'm accessing that tenant admin URL. You're also using the app only token, because I need to have the tenant level permissions and access to admin URL, so I'm able to create new site collections. In this case, we are creating a site collection with the URL of BNP site call. We call that tenant assembly or tenant DLL create site with those properties which we just set in here. And then we do an execute query. The thing about the creation of site collections within Office 365 is that they are actually asynchronous. So what we can do is that we're able to do while operation loop and check every 15 seconds if the status has been changed after that execution query is executed. So when I do this one, I'm actually stepping into that following line pretty fast. So that request is processed, Office 365 starts or has that request now locked relatively fast as a request to create a new site collection. And then it starts looping or checking whenever that request is available or whenever that site collection processing is completed. So what we're doing here is that we take a 15-minute sleep or nap within the process, which doesn't really matter because this is again a remote timer job. And we would really want to make sure that site collection has been processed before we go to the following step. There would be theoretical alternative ways of designs to do this, but still, this is probably the most convenient and the easiest way to think through. Is it completed? The completed is false, and we can still go through and wait a 15 seconds. So this process might take a slightly longer than we want to actually wait within the video. So I'm going to actually do an F5, and with the magic of video editing, I'm going to move away the amount of time actually needed to make this as easily approachable as possible. So I'm going to pause the video recording. I'm going to go back when we hit that following line or the breakpoint, apply template for created site collection. And now, after a while, that was actually surprisingly fast, we are actually done. So the site collection now exists within our Office 365, and we are able to actually go and see that. Let's go and make sure that that site collection exists properly. You're able to see that in the admin UI, and then we're able to access that also using the browser as well. So the site collection has been created, but the site collection is still using that out-of-the-box UIs and out-of-the-box configuration. Now the following part is then to go through and think through how do we modify that newly created site as part of that this site self-service site collection process with the business requirements, with the right branding, with the right settings and right options. So in here we are able to see the BMP request whenever we get the site list of site collections. There we go. Let's actually copy that one. And now if we go to that site collection, we're able to see that it's an out-of-the-box theme site at this moment. But that's not where we actually want to end. We want to have that site columns, content types, branding, all of the custom lists, whatever is needed within the site. And that's what the following part of the code is actually doing. In this case, it's a relatively simple part. It's only going to actually concentrate on the branding. Once again, it takes a context to that newly created URL, newly created site collection, using the app-only access token. Then it applies a garage branding or uploads the garage branding to that site collection. And that's essentially uploading the needed files for that custom theme called Garage, which is using a Seattle.muster. And then it applies that theme to that site collection as well. And applying a theme again, one takes slightly longer because an applying of a theme will override the CSS settings, or it will actually create some dynamic CSS files on fly to that newly created site collection. So that takes us slightly more than, and for example, just adding a property called alternate CSS property or whatever is needed. There we go. And then the following step is that we're actually uploading a logo to the host web. And then we could be adding the logo to the host web app as well. Unfortunately, that's now uncommented within this implementation. Now we have applied our business requirement. We could have done much more than this. Now, right now, we actually just added a custom theme to the site. We could have actually created site collection. We could have created, sorry, lists and libraries and all of those things, site columns and content types. But anyway, now it's already customized based on your custom branding, custom based on the custom requirements for this particular deployment, and it's looking pretty nice. And it's essentially now at this point, we'll then send an email for the end user that the site collection is ready and welcome and have fun within your collaboration platform and do whatever you like within the template. And that's it. We have two had two solutions, one for the UI, one was the remote timer job, which is actually responsible of processing the site collection requests. There are multiple different adaptations of the request and approval flow. You could take advantage of the Microsoft Azure storage queues and web jobs as well, which is a really neat way of automating some of that processing if needed. We kept things relatively simple within this example for a purpose, so you're able to more easily adapt what are we actually doing from a code perspective. And that's it. So thanks for your time for watching the video. Moving on to the subsite creation with add-ins. So now that we created the new site collection, how can we override the subsite creation process, and how can we modify and maybe bring additional templates to the subsite creation process as well? Because that's absolutely the following step, what the end users would be asking. So what we can do is that we're able to actually override the out-of-the-box subsite creation experience with your adding, and then create those subsites using the client-side object model or a remote API, RESTful APIs as well. And that's really relatively easily doable, shown by our patterns and practices guidance quite easily, quite simplistic way. What it actually means is that that new subsite link within the SharePoint, where people go and click to create new subsites, we actually override that link to point to a new location. And that new location is actually our provider-hosted application. Which is then responsible of coordinating or actually getting those requests and then creating that subsite to the site as needed using the CSAM/RESTful APIs. And then we get that new subsite available with whatever customizations and modification needs to happen there. And this is a relatively easily doable set. The only key point here is that you really need to consider that subsite overriding that subsite creation link as part of your site collection provisioning. So you don't have to install anything specific to the site. You actually apply that subsite creation experience, a subsite override experience as part of the initial site collection provisioning approach. And after that, then obviously, whenever we create a subsite, we will add that same override to the subsite as well, using the similar approaches, using the adding approaches. And let's have a look on this one in practice within our demo. So this is really showing the subsite provisioning and how we can modify the subsite creation experience within the SharePoint without impacting or changing the end user behavior. So the end user still go to the subsite, create a subsite link, they click that one, but then we are being redirected actually to a different location. And then we actually create the sites using the adding model techniques. Hello. In this video, we'll have a look on how we can override the subsite creation experience within a SharePoint site so that you're able to introduce your provider-hosted application as the alternative UI for creating subsites. This is one of the samples from the Patterns and Practices, Office 365 Patterns and Practices guidance, and this is one of those typical samples where we use a provider-hosted application since you need to have a sufficient amount of control within the code. In certain scenarios, maybe the JavaScript object model would work because you are actually able to create subsites using the JavaScript object model. But as a rule of thumb, we've been using a provider-hosted application platform because it provides us additional flexibility within the customization. So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to do an F5 or already deployed the application so that we don't have the trust icon, trust dialog shown when we actually open up the things. And we will be redirected automatically to the subsite or to the application side itself. And this initial experience is not precisely what are we actually looking for, but we used the application to actually show or create the site with the proper configuration. So in your case, you might have then a different set of templates. Let's give it a name. Let's call it a subsite. Let's use a sub as the URL as well, and we can give some sort of a description. If needed, you can customize the subsite experience any way you want for the end users. And now that I click Create, what's going to happen is that we start the subsite creation process in our provider-hosted application. And in reality, what we're doing is that we are using the web creation object, which is the one which we can use to create subsites. So what I'm going to do here, that I'm going to let the code actually execute. It takes a while because it's creating that subsite, and then it's actually uploading some additional files. And then we go back and have a look on how did we achieve this customization. Subsite creation typically is a synchronous operation because the end user is kind of an assuming that he or she is redirected to the subsite when the subsite is created. So therefore it's a synchronous operation, and we show that GIF, well, we can show whatever GIF animation we want for waiting the subsite to be created. And there we go, we have a subsite which has a custom theme and some custom logo and some additional custom settings applied. And now this site is actually showing how the subsite creation can be overridden because this is now already provisioned by us. And that's essentially the trick. So you really want to own the site collection provisioning so you're able to apply the needed customizations to these sites. As an example, you are able to now override this new subsite link within a subsite settings using the JavaScript embedding mechanism. And what I mean with that one is that now that if I click this one, you won't be actually redirected to the out-of-the-box subsite creation application or subsite creation experience. And sorry for that small hiccup. You are redirected to the application UI. Essentially, we are now in our provider-hosted application site, in this particular case, in the dev environment, in a local host. So in a real world, that would be obviously some sort of a subsite creation app, .contoso.com, or whatever you use within the Microsoft Azure or within your on-premises. And now we're able to then start creating additional subsite underneath this subsite, and it's applying all the needed customizations to the site automatically. But how did that actually happen? So how did we override that subsite creation experience? And that's done by using the JavaScript embedding mechanism. So as part of the provisioning, we are uploading the needed files, and let me actually show the code in here. So first of all, what we do is that we create that new web using the web creation information object, which is available natively within CSUN. We can set some things like URL, title, description, and also the language. In this case, it's only English. It could be some other logic what you want to use. We're adding that to the web's collection and doing execute query. That's the one moment when it's actually executing that executing that chains or creating that subsite underneath that particular site. Then we have to do three different things here, or four actually. We are adding a JS link, and the JS link is essentially by taking advantage of so-called JavaScript embed pattern, where we are using user custom action to embed a custom set of scripts within the site. And let me actually explain what I'll be doing here. So we have a script URL, which we build dynamically, which is pointing actually to our provider hosted application. So we want to have a one centralized location where that JavaScript is actually hosted. So now you have a one location where you can modify the JavaScript. Well, it could absolutely point to some CDN. It could point to some other logic as well. And then we create the script and script tags where we actually reference that URL in our script creation. So essentially that's where we include the JavaScript source being that particular URL, which is the customer's injects javascript.js. And then we actually do that embedding. Well, first of all, we'd see if that's existing, if there's an old entry on that one, but then in here we're doing actually the right thing. So this is a user custom action collection from the particular web, and we will add a new user custom action to that user custom action collection by adding that to the collection and saying execute, and that will essentially mean, well, actually, we're adding an item, we're getting that user custom action instance, we're adding the description, location, and the script block, which we just built above. Then we do an update, and then we execute the query. And this means that now, whenever we execute that page, we will have a reference to that JavaScript page itself. So let's actually have a look on this one. If I do view source find custom, and let me actually go back on the code. Let's have a look on what did we add here. There we go. Let's search for that one. And it's actually embedded in a different level. Okay, we're not going to worry about that one. Oop, let me switch back in here. Let me do it to F12 and show you how it's actually embedded in the individual JavaScript. So it slightly depends again on how the embedding is done, but typically it's done using the user custom action. So now we're able to see that custom injected JavaScript as one of the files which are loaded automatically as part of the page rendering. So now if I actually open up that one, we're able to see that there's a custom JavaScript which is executed as part of the site creation. And I'm not going to actually zoom here. I'm going to switch back on the Visual Studio and I'm going to show you that file directly from the Visual Studio so we can actually more easily take advantage of the zooming. So in the custom injected JavaScript, we are first of all taking care of the MDS, the minimal download strategy. So regardless is it used or not, the JavaScript will be executed. And then we have here code, which is essentially looking into getting things executed. So that's function call, which is for referring to this one, which is essentially checking that is the are we currently in the view lists ASPX underneath the layout folder or the URL, and if we are, we are making a override or executing this particular function. And what we do is that we take an instance to that create new site link, which has its own ID. It has been having that own ID since 2007 version, and we in engineering are aware of this customization option. So that ID is going to be there in the future as well. And then we update that ID or the URL for that href tag to wherever we want to actually upload that. In this particular case, this is a provider hosted application or demo environment and in provider hosted application, so I'm using just the local host. In reality, you could do something like configuring this URL in a root list of the tenant and then read that dynamically there, so we're able to pinpoint where the users are actually arriving when they click that link. So you don't have to you don't have to override that as a hard-coded value. But now we dynamically then change the href tag or the property for the link to point to that URL, and the result will be that the end users are redirected to that application. So they won't be redirected to the out-of-the-box experience, they will be redirected to the application itself. And this way we are able to then provide that end user, slightly change the end user experience, and then it's up to you or up to your business requirements how this application would look like. So the subsite creation, what are the templates, what are the information, what do we actually request from the end user. But relatively simple functionality, relatively simple to implement, and hopefully that makes sense to how you can change the end user behavior. That's all we're going to do in this video, so thanks for your time. Moving into the hybrid patterns for provisioning, so it's quite a lot, many of our customers and larger customers are looking into hybrid model. And what we mean with that one is that you have an on-premises deployment and you have a cloud deployment. And then you want to actually make sure that you have a consistency across the deployment, or you might have a self-service site collection creation UI, and based on the metadata, is the site confidential or not confidential, the site is either created to the on-premises or to the cloud. And within the hybrid deployments, absolutely, we can enable the single sign-on between the on-premises and cloud, but that's more about the identity and ADFS configuration, which we won't be covering within this particular slide deck. But anyway, the idea is that we provision sites cross on-premises and cloud based on the same based on the business requirements. We take advantage of cost efficiency in the cloud, but still provision some of the sites in on-premises if needed. It might be due to business reasons. And how we do this is that we use the remote APIs to provision sites to specific environments as needed and based on the end user selection. There's actually two different kind of patterns and approaches on doing this. The kind of a classic pattern is the host, the on-premise, the self-service site collection creation, or drive the site collection creation from the on-premises. And that's where the end user actually goes and selects gives the metadata, and based on the metadata, we either create the site to the on-premises, or we create the site that offers Office 365. Obviously, what is the decision-making rule? Is it an on-prem or the Office 365? That absolutely depends on the customer, by customer case. But both of these are absolutely easily doable. It's extremely easy to create site collections to Office 365 running a code within the on-premises. As long as you have the authenticated user or you have the OAuth setup or OAuth approval to do that in the Office 365 given to you by your tenant administrator, it's extremely easily doable within the cloud. The kind of a slightly different approach is cloud-driven hybrid. And what we mean with that one is that we actually host that code to create or orchestrate the site collection creation towards on-premises or Office 365 in a Microsoft Azure. And from the Microsoft Azure, we can absolutely and extremely easily create site collections to the Office 365. It's a cloud-to-cloud discussion. To on-premises, this is slightly more complicated, but we can take advantage of Service Bus, so Microsoft Azure Service Bus technologies, which doesn't require that you expose any endpoints from your on-premises. What you need to have, however, is somebody who's hosting a connection or hosting the let's say the Service Bus client in the on-premises side. And what will happen is that on-premises hosting server or the hosting code will be interconnected with a two-dimensional communication channel directly to the Microsoft Azure. So what happens is that whenever that request is stored in the Microsoft Azure, that code will actually get that request as well, and that's able to then create the site collection to the on-premises phone. That number four bullet point could actually be happening, or that the code in the on-premises could be actually hosted, for example, a Windows service as part of your SharePoint service farm servers. So you don't have to necessarily have additional servers hosting that code within your on-premises. And like mentioned, you don't need to have anything in your DMC. You don't need to expose any endpoints from your on-premises to the Office 365 because we are taking advantage of this Service Bus Relay capability. That code hosted in on-premises will connect to the Microsoft Azure, and it's actually essentially looking into it. Do we have any requests to execute a code within the on-premises? When we do, it will actually create the site collection in on-premises site. To save some time, we don't actually have a demo on this one, but there are many demos. There are demos recorded on this process, and there's a ready-to-use code as part of the patterns and practices guidance available for you to consume as well. The final topic is then updating site collection after initial provisioning. So, what now? We created those site collections, we created those subsites, but whenever we need to modify those sites, how do we actually do that? And how do we approach this updating of those existing sites using the adding model? So this is a slightly different approach than what we used to do with the farm solutions in on-premises. And what we mean with that one is that, first of all, you really want to consider whether you store your static elements, like images, CSS files, and JavaScript files, because you want to actually store them in one location. You don't want to deploy them to every single site collection, because that would have an impact for your maintenance perspective or the updating process perspective. And the process is relatively simple. We loop through all of the sites and site collections to apply those modifications one by one. And it's absolutely true that if you have 200,000 sites or 400,000 site collections, this process will take a while when you're applying the new branding, for example, towards your site collections. But at the same time, this doesn't actually require any downtime. So we're able to process, for example, 100 sites as a pilot and then 2,000 sites in every single hour or every single weekend, or 20,000 or 100,000 sites in one weekend to use the newly applied branding or new version of your customizations. You don't have the same benefit that with the farm solution, where you actually had a one version of truth within a 15 hive within a file system, but that's just due to the nature of the adding model. So does it really mean that I need to loop through all of the sites and update the stuff one by one? And this is absolutely the way to do. The key point here to realize that this does not require any downtime. It does not require mean that all of your sites are non-accessible when you're applying the new version of your customization or new version of your branding to these sites. And you're able to apply all of those at the same time when end users are accessing the files which are stored within the sites. And the second point, which we mentioned already, is that you really want to think through where do you have those static assets. So like in this case, the master pages and page layouts, if you use custom master pages, they have to be deployed to every single site collections. It's just the nature of a master page. But the JavaScript files, CSS files, and PNG files, or images in general, you could actually store them, for example, in the root site collection of your tenant, which would be one option. Or you could actually just as well to host them within your provider hosted application site. So within your references, you're pointing to an external URL, which is then hosting the JavaScript images and CSS files. And then you have a one location where you're able to control and refresh those files. You can absolutely take advantage of a content delivery networks as well, like the Microsoft Azure Content Delivery Networks, to host these files in a single location as well. That's absolutely absolutely valid approach for your deployments as well. One approach, one point what we wanted to also kind of a remind on this one is that we really want to consider this upgrade requirement from day one when you start implementing stuff. So typically how we are approaching this is to have really a reusable component, which is the one which is giving us the remote capability, remote access capabilities to, for example, easily update the master page or easily update the alternate CSS within the site collection or within the site level. And then you are able to call that component from provider hosted applications or a PowerShell or console application, whatever is your chosen approach for the deployment. As part of the patterns and practices, there is patterns and practices core component, which is essentially exactly this component, making your life much more easier for operating and applying individual customizations to site collections and sites. So let's go through the recommendations one more time. We went through this when we started the presentation and the video, but now they probably make more sense. So do not use CIDO web templates. They do have that maintenance challenge of our consistent updates, which we push in the Office 365 and also in on-premises. The approach to use is the remote provisioning pattern, which will be much more beneficial, and you're able to debug your deployment code as well, because it's not using XML. You don't have to use an XML to actually do this. We don't also recommend you to deploy artifacts using feature framework. We want you to use remote APIs to do that, and you're able to then pinpoint, for example, the right locations in a site style library for your CSS and JavaScript files. And then the final topic was that we recommend using the remote management pattern, remote APIs, for updates as well, which means that you need to scan through your site collections, but it doesn't require any downtime to do that, so you're able to apply the modifications one by one across the site collections. We're not going to take any questions in the video, and the key point of all of the demos is that all of the demos and much more is available from the AKMS Office Dev PMP. That's Patterns and Practices Guidance for Office 365 and also on-premises SharePoint add-in model. So there's a lot of samples, a lot of ready-to-use code, a lot of videos and additional things which you can take granted. This is an open source community-driven program, which is currently facilitated by Microsoft, but we're growing to external people in the program all the time, and we are open for community contributions. The majority of the stuff what we have in the patterns and practices is based on community contributions by the community helping the others within the community. So feel free to join the team for doing that. Also, if you have any questions, AKMS Office Dev PMP Yammer would be the right way to ask any patterns and practices related questions. It's a highly active Yammer group in the Office 365 technical network. One URL to remember for all of the key information, dev.office.com. You can find a lot of additional guidance, a lot of additional trainings, a lot of getting started material, a lot of getting started samples from this location, including the patterns and practices guidance. And we are absolutely interested about your feedback. So the Office 365 network is the one location, the yammer.com/ITProNetwork. And that, even though the name is IT Pro Network, it also includes all the development-oriented groups and discussions together with the product group and the Microsoft people. Stack Overflow and user voice. If there's something which is missing, give us a note, give a votes also for the other user voice entries in the user voice. We do have a standardized process to go them through, and then they're tracked, and we can start tackling those missing APIs as an example based on your requests. And that's all we're going to do within this video. So thank you for your time, and hopefully the video is helpful for you.